Okay. This is live, waiting for host to call in. Where do I add you in? I'm not getting the dashboard anymore. Ugh. Hey everyone, good afternoon and welcome to the radio show. We're having a couple of crazy difficulties. I'm not seeing what I saw yesterday, so I'm still trying to add Michelle Milam into the conversation. And I don't know why it's not giving me the same dashboard. I had this all figured out yesterday, and
hey.
Yeah. Hey, there's Michelle.
I added myself in, so.
Okay, great.
I'm sure.
Wow, that's really crazy. Okay, so this is new to me. I'm talking to you on the phone and hoping that folks are out there listening in La La Land, right?
This is not an easy system to use.
All right. I'm telling you, I looked at this yesterday and it was all fine, and I'm not seeing the same thing I logged into yesterday, so I apologize, folks, for getting started a little bit crazy, but welcome, better late than never, to Physical Dimensions of Free Choice Learning, SED 584 at Oregon State University, and to anybody that may just be listening for fun who found us, thanks for tuning in. So, Michelle, I'm not seeing any way to, you know, manage callers and things. Are you seeing that?
Once you're logged in, hit the drop-down that has the picture in the far right corner and click on Studio link, and that will take you to a screen that will show anybody who calls in, and then you will just hit the mic.
There we go.
So if we have anybody listening who wants to call in, we can add you.
Yes. Please do call in if you'd like. The guest call-in number for anyone listening is 347-202-0449. Okay, well, let's get started with what we wanted to talk about today, which is basically an introduction to the course and how it's going to run, and to your instructors, which are me, Katie Sofer, and Michelle Milam, who's here with me too, and answer any questions you might have on that sort of thing if anyone calls in. So I think we have Michelle in... We have two sections of this course, basically, and the radio show is a chance for all of you to talk together. The first section that I teach is for the actual master's and PhD program at Oregon State, and the section that Michelle teaches is for the certificate program taken by a lot of working professionals in museum and other free choice learning settings. So if you all have a chance to call in, you know, it's a chance to interact with both of the instructors and get to know the other folks in the other course a little bit and what they're up to and what sorts of questions they might have. So this is one of three courses in a series of free choice learning courses at Oregon State, and many of you take it starting in the fall in the master's program and PhD program for sure, and start with the personal dimensions of free choice learning, and then in this winter term is sociocultural dimensions, and now physical dimensions is in spring term. But there are also some people who may be taking these courses out of sequence. I'm not aware of anybody in the graduate course this time that is new this term, Michelle. Is there anybody in the certificate that is new?
I think we may have one or two people either new to the certificate, or they've, because in the certificate program you can spread the coursework out over several years, they may have just take this course to wrap up the certificate. So I see some new names in there, which is exciting for me, but I think the majority of the students have taken one, if not both, of the previous classes.
Great. Great. Well, welcome to everyone, whether you are new or returning. Let's just go over, I guess, what to expect in the course, just for a refresher for those who've done it before and new for the new ones. I guess, new for the graduate students, and some of them already had emailed me wondering where the course was that it's in Canvas instead of Blackboard this time. But I think everyone's pretty much figured out the navigation through Canvas so far. We did have another hiccup with uploading photos in a pretty way, figuring out where to put files for their first assignment, but I think that's figured out so far. So hopefully things are pretty smooth there. Michelle, do you want to say anything about Blackboard in particular?
Yeah, because the certificate program, for anybody in that listening, is the last one in the university system to switch over to Canvas, which will be like our new online dashboard that we're using for coursework. So because it's non-credit, we just got bumped to the bottom, which is fine. So starting in the fall, the certificate will start using Canvas. But for the meantime, we're all in Blackboard, and I think everybody's pretty familiar with how to navigate through there. I don't think there's been any issues yet, although I'm still waiting to see some images from some settings. Still waiting to post their pictures. So.
Gotcha. Well, I was going to say the grad students are way ahead of the game, and I'm looking at 18 assignments already submitted, and the due date is Sunday, so... I was never that on top of things as a grad student, so yay for my course. And yeah, that is something a little different also between the graduate course and the certificate course. Obviously, the graduate course being for credit, we are more strict about the deadlines. Obviously, if there are emergencies and things per OSU policy, you know, please feel free to get in touch with me and let me know what sorts of things we can do to work that out. But for the certificate program, it's more paced on your own. And do you want to say something about that?
Yes. So we are fairly flexible. You know, we try to keep everybody on the same timeline that the master's students are on. So, you know, we try to promote, you know, two-week modules, but there's a lot of flexibility within the certificate program. Really, you have a year, essentially, to finish the coursework until we open next year's course, which is, you know, most people finish usually during break time. You know, they may go a couple weeks over the regular allotted 10 weeks. So, but yes, we do have a little bit more flexibility than the master's students, which is wonderful. But all of the certificate students are doing all of the same assignments, the majority of the same readings, the same discussion boards are happening in both courses. So really, they're doing the same kind of rigorous work that the master's students are doing. So it's really a nice opportunity for them as professionals to come and have this experience and get to know some of us here in the college and have that professional and academic world linking together. So it's really exciting, the conversations that are happening.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's the work is no less rigorous, just a little more flexible in the deadlines.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the funny thing about grad school is those deadlines could be a little more flexible if necessary too. So, you know, just I always ask that you give me a heads up ahead of time as much as you can, but we can work things out in most cases. So, because I understand, you know, people are going off to conferences. I'm going to a conference myself next week. People have got data collection and, you know, other like grad school type things going on too. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that structure that Michelle started alluding to. So Oregon State runs on 10-week terms, and so we've got organized this into 5 2-week modules. And so basically they're, what to say about each of them. So this first week, which, you know, most people have already started to dig into, was getting to know this idea of the physical dimensions of free choice learning, and for people that are new to the course sequence, you know, getting to know the contextual model of learning, which is what we use based on John Falk and Lynn Dierking's work from many years in the museum and free choice learning field. So this week, yeah, getting to know what's sort of inviting or hopefully not uninviting about some public spaces. And then We've also got prototyping as a main method that we use with our physical settings. So prototyping in a nutshell is, you know, try it, see what works, test something kind of on the cheap, try it again, see if what works and what doesn't, revise, repeat, you know, kind of shower, rinse, repeat, or lather, rinse, repeat sort of model until you get it right, or as right as you can, or you run out of money or time. Yeah, I think we've all been there, in fact, in that. But then we've got senses and emotions that are elicited as we're in particular places. And Michelle, shall I leave modules 4 and 5 for you to talk about?
Oh my gosh, I didn't prep for that, so no.
Okay. Well,
I can't commit all to memory. I should, but I haven't.
That's okay. So this one is, module 4 is interesting because the activity that goes along with it is actually not an activity related to the reading so much. It's more about the kind of getting ready for the final project. So this one is, sort of a wrap-up, I guess, of some other issues in physical dimensions of free choice learning. So in the talk about it, in the Let's Talk discussion, we talk about, different activities and just kind of the overall setting of where your study is going to take place. And then Module 5 is really the wrap-up of all of it and putting everything together as you do your prototyping study in a real space. I don't know, Michelle, you've taught this before, now that I've reminded you a little bit. Are there things that that come to mind that I didn't hit on?
No, it's that all sounds great. Sorry, yes, and I'm navigating two different courses, so the module 4s and module 5s get mixed up in my brain quite easily. But no, you hit it spot on. And what I really want to emphasize is what you said about prototyping as a methodology. That's something that comes up in I think the majority of the assignments. I think certainly. Module 2 assignment kind of gives the students the first opportunity to use prototyping and to understand how that works, which is really important for putting the final assignment together. I think one of the things that I saw a lot of last year was this not necessarily misuse of prototyping, but not really using prototyping to the full extent of how it should be used. And Katie, said it, where it is this kind of test-retest with collecting data in between. So it's not designing 3 activities and seeing which one works best, comparing and contrasting, but designing one, collecting results, understanding what works and what doesn't, and redesigning, collecting results and seeing from there what works and what doesn't. And that's really important. You'll be modeling that in module 2, and you really need to keep that in mind for the final assignment. So, but yes, module 4, it gives you some time to put your ideas out there of what you want to focus on, and gives you a good 2 weeks to know what you might need to change before actually carrying out your final assignment.
Yes. Yeah. And module 4 and 5 especially get into the real practical methods of doing some of that stuff, and most importantly, I guess, in module 4, how to connect or look at, the influence of the physical exhibit on actual learning, which is really why we're all here, right? We want to improve experiences for learning. And, of course, in free choice learning, we define learning in a lot of different ways, but, however you're setting your goals for that exhibit or that physical setting, whatever it may be, really connecting that prototyping and the changes that you make, and really setting goals that let you examine that learning in a meaningful way. So I think that's, you know, kind of the main point of the course, is to really get, you know, down and dirty, as we've done in some of the other two courses in the sequence, and really, you know, get some hands-on experience. Just like we feel like our best learning for our visitors or our participants is doing it hands-on and really, you know, doing it yourself and learning through experience, basically that's the same way we've got these courses set up. So, Michelle, anything to add about course structure?
I just want to bring up one thing, a note that came up while I'm sitting here, is clarifying the difference between prototyping and formative evaluation. And, Katie, I don't know if you maybe have thoughts you can add to this, but just understanding, for those of you who are familiar with this structure of kind of the front-end formative and summative evaluations, how prototyping is different from that. You know, to me, this is a little bit more, prototyping is more kind of quick, more quickly thought out than formative evaluation is, where you may not have done that front end, and it's not this long-term understanding of how an exhibit is working. To me, prototyping, say you're putting together an exhibit, and so this can go in with kind of your front-end evaluation. You're putting together an exhibit, you have signage, you want to understand if the font is too big or too small or placed correctly, or if the buttons are easy to navigate, say on a website, are the drop-down menus easy to find or explanatory, and making small little changes that way. It is similar to formative evaluation that you are changing, but prototyping is really about, to me, formative is that you do that and you make changes and then you carry on, and prototyping to me is doing it more quickly of a turnaround and doing several iterations.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that prototyping could be part of, you know, certainly either the front end or formative evaluations, but that it's, you're right, it's for a real specific purpose to test out, in the physical realm anyway, to test out very specific kind of differences in the layouts and things like that. Yep, that's great. Whereas your evaluation is more looking at the learning overall and the goals overall. So, yeah, you're definitely connecting to learning in both situations, but maybe on a different scale is a good way to think about it. So within each module, we've got a couple of different activities to do over the 2 weeks. We've got readings for each of the five modules, and with those readings, we have a discussion board to talk about, you know, what you're finding in there. And then there's an assignment each 2 weeks that has its own discussion board that links back the readings and the activity and kind of is in order to sum up the entire module. So I will say that my grad students haven't, looks like, done most of their second week discussion board linking their activity and the readings yet. So maybe they're more on track than I remember being as a grad student. And they all did their activities this weekend, and we'll be posting sort of throughout this week. And then the final project is, as we talked about a little bit, for Module 5, actually carrying out a prototyping study. And so the activities each week are designed to lead you to Week 4, where you each module, the activities are designed to lead you up to Module 4, where you plan the prototyping, you get some feedback from your instructors, and then in Module 5, you actually carry out the prototyping and do a report on how that worked, you know, what elements you found successful, what you didn't find successful, what you would do in the future, and basically, the, you know, tying it all together is the point of our final project. So, yeah, and everything, you know, being done online is you know, posted through Blackboard or Canvas to submit your assignments. And then, of course, the radio show in week two of each module is a chance for, you know, all of us to get together, hopefully in a live fashion, and, you know, talk about, you know, what questions you have, what you're finding in the readings, and sort of things like that. So I think that's all I have to cover for structure. Michelle, do you have
that? No, I don't. I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay, great. So maybe let's take a few minutes to tell you all a little bit about who we are. Obviously, if you watched the intro videos, that's another part of the course. There are many lectures that give a little more discussion and depth from some experts at Oregon State and elsewhere on the content of the modules. We each as instructors did a welcome video trying to let you know a little bit about our backgrounds, but now I can go a little more in depth because, hey, I have the time and people aren't calling in with questions, so I like to, you know, share a little bit about me, and you can, you know, maybe check in later and see a little bit more about me. But I went through Oregon State's Free Choice Learning Program a few years ago, so I was one of the first to do it in this two-week format and this online kind of modules. But it's a relatively young program at Oregon State and frankly, across the nation, too. But, you know, we've seen changes over the last few years. But I started out as a biology major as an undergraduate and thought I was going to do research on neuroscience and spent actually a couple of years in a neuroscience lab doing neuroimaging, and I had this big idea that I would be able to someday connect, you know, learning and looking at how people's brains were reacting in real time and changing blood flow, which is what you're looking at in an fMRI, and looking at what sections of the brain are most active in particular tasks. But I decided that was, you know, actually not, you know, very applied enough for me, and I went back and got a master's degree in journalism, in science journalism, in fact, and thought I would, you know, help translate research findings for public audiences and really inspire people to get excited about science and feel empowered to use science in their lives. And crazily enough, I just took on a museum job part-time as a grad student in Boston at the Museum of Science, which is a really fantastic, long history, long-lived science museum, and just started working, you know, talking with visitors actually in a temporary exhibit that they had there, and through that actually got some other part-time jobs, one of which was actually prototyping for an exhibit that they were building on modeling. And so I spent my summer, one of my summers in grad school working on actually doing a lot of prototyping, and so we basically had kind of a general plan for the exhibit. You know, we had the theme, obviously, about modeling, and the exhibit designers had created a bunch of different, you know, exhibit pieces or individual interactives that they thought might work based on, you know, things that they already had in the museum that they could repurpose or other sorts of things. And that they had found at other museums or through conferences and the like. And we went out and, yeah, did real quick and dirty versions on the floor and saw how they worked or didn't with visitors. We would test out the instructions. We'd test out the actual gameplay if it was a computer game. One of the things I really worked with was an exhibit case that was supposed to give examples of, you know, models and have people think about, you know, what was a model and what wasn't. And so we put all sorts of things in there from, I actually still have in my office a little volcano made of pipe cleaners. So I have a little brown pipe cleaner that's kind of wrapped around in a kind of upside down cone shape and a little red pipe cleaner coming out of it. And, you know, things very abstract like that and artsy models all the way to maps as models of, you know, towns and cities, to computer models that might run simulations of data. You know, these days, certainly climate models are one of those more famous ones. And so after I finished my master's degree, I went on actually to work in public relations and video development for a couple years at NASA, but came back to the museum again and got a job working for several years at the Maryland Science Center as an Earth Science News exhibit designer and manager. And that was really a big prototype in and of itself, because we really wanted to make an exhibit that was flexible and could respond to news. And so we really had a lot of video screens and computer screens, and we're constantly trying to change things out and try and follow the news there, and really, you know, start conversations with visitors about what was going on. One of the really sad events that happened while I was there, but really made for great news, was the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004. And that happened right after Christmas, which of course is a big museum visitation time, and we, you know, were featuring all sorts of coverage about the tsunami just as fast as we could get it from CNN and things like that. And that was a really interesting time in you know, trying out things and just seeing what worked in this real flexible museum space. And through that, I got involved with the Science on a Sphere, which I talked about a little bit in my intro video, which was this 6-foot diameter globe that NOAA, the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, had started purposing into an educational tool. And Maryland Science Center was one of the first ones to get that. And I got involved with the network, and Sean from Oregon State, Sean Rowe, said, "Hey, you should come, you know, do research on that with me." And sure enough, I did. And now here I am at the University of Florida, trying to continue to find out how people learn in settings that are outside of school. So that's a summary of the last, 20 years of my life and how I got to here. So, Michelle, you want to share what your work is?
I'll share a little bit about myself. For the master's students who don't have access to my introduction video, this will just be a smaller, I don't know, possibly extended version of it. So like Katie, I have a bachelor's degree in biology, and like Katie, thought that I would do science research at the graduate level and as a career. And in my senior year, when I was at Butler University in Indianapolis, and our biology department partnered with a local city park and their nature center. And so they came to campus and recruited for volunteer naturalists to come and of course, you know, lead different activities with different family groups or different visitors, you know, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and homeschooled groups, all this. And so I was like, well, that sounds like fun. And so I signed up and went and became a volunteer and did that for the majority of my senior year, and really loved it, loved every minute of being at this nature center and seeing people experience science outside of a lab, just making those connections, understanding that kids hadn't seen a turtle or touched a turtle before, and getting a turtle out of a tank and you know, letting them touch it. They're fascinated, you know, just little things like that. So when I was looking at graduate schools, I wanted to stick in the sciences, and so I applied for environmental sciences and conservation tracks, and in my application letter had this little, this kind of one or two lines, really, about connecting people with science through these out-of-school learning experiences. I really didn't even know how to describe it at the time. And when I applied to Oregon State, the person working in the office here in the environmental sciences program said, "You need to talk to Sean Rowe." And so I did. And we had a nice long phone conversation, and he explained free choice learning to me and what they do and the research. And I was just like, that's it. So, like, that is what I want to do. And so I came out and started in the program. And I'm unique in the sense that I am technically in the environmental sciences program, which falls directly under the graduate school. So we are not in one of the specific colleges on campus. We're interdisciplinary. So we pull from each and every college across campus. And Sean Rowe is now my advisor. He was for my master's while I was here doing my master's. And I'm currently doing a PhD and just rolled right on into that program. And so what's unique is being in environmental sciences, having the science background, but crossing over with the College of Education and the Free Choice Learning program and kind of understanding and their resources and really bridging the two. So that's kind of where I'm at now. And, you know, I'm one of those people who has gone straight through school. So, I have some experience from things that I've been involved with while I'm here, while I've been here for the last five or so years. And other than that, you know, unlike Katie, it's like I haven't been in a museum world for an extended period of time. I actually have done very little prototyping, but I do a lot of evaluation work, front-end, formative, and summative evaluations for several different museum and school programs. So I'm just kind of all over the place and still finding out a path for the next 30 years.
Yeah, well, sometimes I think that there's a lot of those years that I feel like I'll still be finding out what my path is. Obviously,
yeah.
In the last 20, I've spent a lot of time doing that, and I think that's okay. Honestly, I kind of think that's my own free choice learning experience in that situation. But I'm gonna remind anyone that might be listening that you can call in live while we're on the air at 347-202-0449. We're about halfway through our show, got about 26 minutes left, and it may just be Michelle and I just talking at you some more if you guys don't have questions. But looking back through what folks have posted, one question was from Ellie in the graduate course, and she asked if we were going to be covering signs in particular. She's noticed at the Seattle Aquarium, for one thing, there's a door that people seem to miss, and wants to know if something like that would be a topic that, you know, we'll be looking at. And absolutely. Signage of all types. In fact, one of the prototyping projects that was in my term was at Hatfield Marine Science Center, a very similar thing. There is a little room at the very end of the basic path that people follow that a lot of people overlook, either overlook or, you know, just by virtue of being at the end of their exhibit, you know, it's not as cool maybe as the touch tanks, or the kids are, you know, tugging the parents to go, or, wow, we spent more time at that other exhibit than we thought, so it kind of got overlooked. But one of the projects that my fellow student did was to try and create something that would be a little more inviting and a little more obvious to draw people in. So Laura actually put a set of footprints on the floor and tried various... Michelle, do you remember, were you in that term with us? Do you remember exactly what she tried? I think she had the footprints and then, you know, kind of just different, you know, spacing of the footprints, different numbers of the footprints, different direction maybe, and those sorts of things in her rounds of prototyping. I can't remember if she did other sorts of signs or other sorts of things on the floor either. I feel like there was something besides just the footprints, but it's escaping me for a minute. Well, we're hoping to have Dr. Laura Good come back and talk with us in one of the upcoming radio shows, and maybe we'll ask her what she remembers from that project from a few years ago. Do you remember your project? Do you want to talk about your project at all, Michelle?
You know, I remember my project, but I took this course so long ago because I took this during my master's, and I actually was one of those students who took them out of order. So I started, this was the first class that I took in the series, and the course was set up differently when I took it, and we did have a final, and I did something on my computer. I used PowerPoint to essentially create an exhibit. And again, going to Hatfield Marine Science Center at the time, we had, touch technology was fairly new, and getting the computer screens that were touch sensitive to navigate through exhibits. And so I created through PowerPoint an exhibit, essentially, that could go on one of these touch screen computers about pollution, water pollution traveling from land to the ocean, and set it up to be used on that. So it was, we didn't do prototyping when I went through the course. So
okay.
It was really just framing what how you would apply physical dimensions to a project. And of course, my physical dimension was having that kind of touch screen interactivity at an exhibit.
So, great.
Yeah.
Well, and my project was a fairly standard exhibit signage. So instead of room signage, as Ellie was asking about, I guess, I was really looking at exhibit labels, I suppose, or interactive labels. In fact, I looked at a tank in the Marine Science Center that held jellies, or as some people call them, jellyfish. But the jellies in this case were in this special kind of tank that was round to help the water circulate, and so that the jellies could, you know, continually move in the manner they go. And so the exhibit signage had been a very standard kind of text-heavy label that was, this is what a jelly is. This is what a, you know, this is why the tank is this way. This is why, you know, it was very explanatory. And one of the things that, you know, in the going into this interactive sort of experiential and contextual model, again, is, you know, trying to get people to actually interact and, you know, use their social groups that we know that they attend the museum in, and bring in their prior experiences and really connect, because we know that's how people learn best. So I worked on redoing the labels. I tried actually a flip label. So if you've been in a museum, oh, this is going to be fun to describe over the radio. Hopefully this will make sense. But you basically have a label that's the answer, and then maybe a question on top of it hiding the answer, and then you can flip up that question and see a little bit of an answer underneath after supposedly you've thought about it and hopefully talked about it with your group and whoever else might be around you. So I tried to see if that would, you know, see if people would linger longer and actually use those, and so I actually also moved them around and again, it's hard to describe how the tank was, but basically I put it, there was kind of a shelf under the tank that the tank was sitting on, so I had them there for a while, then there was sort of a backdrop behind it. I had them, you know, vertically on the backdrop for a while. And as we go through the course, you should see, you know, it'll make a little more sense. We talk about, you know, things from text size to materials of the actual labels and interactive pieces like these questions to the placement and where, you know, whether it's something that's visible. So maybe on the horizontal it was actually easier for a child to reach physically, but it may not have been so obvious because you might have had to look down and it wasn't in your line of sight, maybe more so when it was vertical. So those are the sorts of things that we're all looking at in the prototyping and in this physical dimensions course.
Yeah, that's a nice segue, Katie, just to maybe focus on where the students are right now with this the entrance spaces of museums or other free choice learning sites that they think are applicable in this for this assignment. And to think about the architecture and kind of the big picture design of museums. So, you know, I remember when I took this course, we had the same assignment, and I think it was one of my favorites, to be honest. And I remember I included as one of my three images, I'm from Springfield, Illinois, land of Lincoln, so the Presidential Library and Museum had just opened. So I included the entrance to the museum as one of my images, and it sparked this discussion. Of course, it's big and grandiose, and it's marble and large columns, and what that kind of says about a space and how welcoming it may be for some versus others. And so I think it's kind of similar to this sign. signage, right, that you really have to think that, you know, low signs are very easily approached by children and they understand what to do with them. And, you know, adults may find them at a very awkward level. So these are the types of scaled things that we're thinking about with this physical dimensions course. So I was just wondering if you had some of your examples or one from this course of the entry space that you looked at, and maybe say something about that welcoming space, what that means to you.
Oh, man, I knew as soon as you started talking about that you were going to ask what I had posted. You know, it's funny. I don't remember, and I would have to look and see. But you know, the entry space that I remember, you know, working with most often would be either the Museum of Science Boston or the Maryland Science Center. So I can talk a little bit about, you know, what those two looked like. Museum of Science Boston was really interesting thinking back on it because it's a really large building. I mean, this is a massive complex. It's got, you know, I think both an Omnimax theater and a planetarium in it. It's got these huge long wings. It was probably, you know, a good two or three city blocks from one end to another, it was just a very old style. Like, if you've ever been to a Smithsonian Museum or to the American Museum of Natural History, I mean, the big city museums, the Field Museum, it's just on that scale. But the way you would get into it, actually, there was a big long driveway that would run for quite a bit of it, and also the elevated, sometimes elevated, sometimes subway, their train system, would go by it. And so it honestly was a pretty boring entrance, but I think part of that was because it was an older building, and maybe they've you know, updated it since then. But actually the side of the building facing the river, which was not a way that you could actually access it, of course, at all, but that kind of front of it was a little bit more exciting. It was still kind of plain brick, but I remember it had a few architectural details, I can't even remember, like a flask, a chemistry flask or something, like, you know, sort of like a gargoyle on the side of the building, but science related. It was just, yeah, it wasn't a really pretty building, but it was big, and so I would say imposing, if nothing else, and not necessarily, I mean, you know, hard to navigate, but... Now, the Maryland Science Center, on the other hand, was redesigned. So it opened, I believe, originally in the 1970s, and it was at the waterfront also in Baltimore. And it was redesigned around the time I started. They added a big wing to it, and they really did a lot of nice architecture to make the space on the harbor side where the entrance was really inviting. I would say they meant to make it inviting. It was kind of modern looking, and so maybe some people might have found that actually displeasing, but I think it was pretty obvious that it was kind of supposed to be a fun sort of place. There was a lot of glass, and you could see really into our big dinosaur hall there and really get an idea of what kind of dinosaurs you could see. So there was, you know, kind of a preview, that sort of feeling, and it was a nice, you know, it fit in with the harbor well, I think. The brick walkway kind of continued, and there was, you know, so I would say that one was a little more welcoming, at least from my perspective. But yeah, I don't remember what other ones I actually posted about at that back in those days. But
yeah, that is a good point, though, of offering kind of a preview of visitors coming to a museum and expecting, you know, what they see to match with their kind of mental image of, you know, what a science museum may be or what a history museum may be or what an art museum may be. And I think that was one of the things that came up when I was talking about the Presidential Museum, is that realistically, large columns and marble floors and very big open a foyer, it can be somewhat uninviting, you know, to families who may have small children, you know, where it's like, is this a place I can run? Is this a place I can touch things? You don't really, you know, you may have some apprehensions about how you act in that particular setting. But at the same time, it's a presidential museum. So the site and the architecture have to match that notion of this kind of great character in American history. So it's just interesting to think through as people are either choosing their images still or as you're commenting on others, thinking about all those aspects.
Yeah, that's really smart, a really interesting thing. So the funny thing is, on the other side of the harbor, the opposite corner was the aquarium, which in Baltimore saw more visitors. And I could go on and on about, you know, all of that sort of background. But, you know, I don't think it was actually as welcoming of a building, but I think it was originally, its facade was done also maybe back in the 80s and you know, was a little bit older. So I should say that, if I didn't say, the Maryland Science Center wing was added in 2004. So really in the midst of, you know, kind of this real explosion of free choice learning. So if you all aren't really familiar with kind of the history of interactive science museums, at least, basically the science museums grew out of natural history museums, which were very object-focused. But then in around the 60s, with the Exploratorium, there was a guy whose name escapes me right at the moment, but basically who founded the Exploratorium, that really made it an interactive, hands-on, exploratory place. And so it's really since the 60s that science centers, especially, you know, the traditional old ones like Franklin Institute, Smithsonian, Boston Museum of Science, have even, you know, sort of adopted to any extent this model of interactive. And, you know, as they've had time and staff and resources and money to revamp their exhibits, I think they are going more and more. But then, so then this idea of doing research in them and really understanding them as a learning space, I think, is even more recent than that. And, you know, that's why the Oregon State program is pretty much the first of its kind, and it was started in, I think, 2004, basically. So John Falk and Lynn Dierking have been doing work in this field since the early 80s, I want to say. So that gives you a timeline of, like, you know, why there's only sort of a few of us doing this and where that kind of all fits in the big picture, and why the physical buildings, you know, may be more or less inviting based on when they were built. So certainly some of the more recent ones or more recently renovated ones could have a whole different look. Another thing that I think about, now that I'm at the University of Florida, we have a Museum of Natural History here, and, you know, I'm sure one of its constraints when it was built was that it needed to fit in with the university as well. So if it wanted to be like this fun, crazy, like, bright blue, yellow, orange, whatever, gator colors maybe, I'm sure the architects of the university and the actual kind of president and things would have probably vetoed that idea and said, no, you know, we really need to make sure it fits in with the campus and, you know, that sort of idea of cohesiveness. So, you know, especially thinking about the architecture that's around you, that's another constraint on whether something looks inviting or not, and or whether it goes as far as, you know, to be funky or not, or super modern. I mean, you can think of things like the Guggenheim Museum in New York, and the other thing that designer made in Los Angeles. There's a symphony hall that was just basically turned out to be an eyesore, according to the community, because it was too modern and too, and actually I think the glass reflected off it in strange ways and, like, you know, into office windows nearby and things like that. So, you know, it's definitely a balance, and I think that's something to remember in your prototyping is, again, you're going to have constraints, physical constraints, but, you know, what works in one situation could work very differently in your situation, And yeah, we have all this theoretical, you know, research and things. But to bring back to another comment that Amber made in the introduction is that, you know, prototyping is also very practical, and especially with the physical dimensions. And in this resource-limited, you know, nonprofit museum world, or you know, we have other folks in Extension and other camps and national parks and things. In all of those situations, you're balancing the practical and pragmatic and actual evidence base with what the theory tells you and what you would design based on that. So really trying to combine that. And I think that's, you know, a real strength of the course as it's been set up. And I hope you all find that as you go through. And that's really what we're trying to do, is introduce you to some of the background that, you know, and theory that has emerged alongside the evidence, and then the places where we still need evidence to, you know, see how things fit in different situations and that sort of thing. So we've got a few minutes left. Call in number is 347-202-0449. I really encourage you all, if you can, to post questions, you know, for the radio shows in the discussion board. If you get to listen to this later and have questions on this episode, you know, please feel free to post them in the discussion and we'll cover them in the next radio show, or, you know, again, questions to ask us as we go forward. In the upcoming weeks, we're going to hopefully have guest speakers to talk with us. We're planning to, I think, have Dr. Laura Good, who went through the program with Michelle and me at the same time, and is now working at Stanford trying to help graduate students there do better marine outreach with their research. And she was going to, which module were we thinking about? She was going to talk about, Michelle, help me out. I've lost.
Yeah, we're hoping Laura has an extensive background in environmental education and
right.
CAMP, and we were thinking she might give us a little bit of insight into thinking about free choice learning outside of walls of a museum, even engaging
yes.
people in the outdoors. Maybe some of her experiences with that. And I don't know if we were going to try and fit her in with the next module that is architecture psychology or possibly the emotions, senses and the emotions. So,
yep. Ideally, it will be the emotions and senses, because we thought that, you know, she's worked with a lot of YMCA camps and outdoor experiences, as Michelle said, and that's really an opportunity, especially in the absence of some, you know, designed physical structure in a lot of ways, you know, to think about how to take advantage of the, you know, what's already existing around you. We've also got some folks here. I'd like to have someone from the Florida Museum of Natural History potentially, you know, maybe talk to us about prototyping, you know, either one of the modules, 2 or 4, is our plan for that. We're still negotiating with folks and working out their schedules. So definitely, you know, pay attention to when these are going to be held live, because they may change a little bit. We're hoping to have them at this time, 5 o'clock Eastern, 2 o'clock Pacific, in week 2 of each module. But as we work out with the speakers, that may change a little bit. So, you know, but post your questions as you have them, of course, and we will do our best to get those. And if we, you know, connect with the speaker after, because you have a question that, you know, came up after listening to this, you know, asynchronously, that's fine as well. So, So I guess I would also add from my perspective that, you know, we're always happy to take feedback on the course and on the instruction throughout the term. You know, we'll do the standard evaluations, I think Oregon State does, at the end, certainly for the graduate program. But, you know, please feel free, you know, if you've got suggestions or questions about how the course operates or, you know, things like that, to offer them as any time. Oh my gosh, we have a caller. Hello.
Oh,
let's
yay.
Hi, caller.
Hi, Dave.
You're on the air.
Okay, now it's a big reveal. it's Amber from Hawaii Bishop Museum.
Hi, Amber. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, and thanks again for offering this course. I have just a really quick question, especially as you've defined for us the prototype versus front-end and formative evaluation. My question throughout this course is, do you want us with our assignments and pieces to approach everything with more of the kind of prototype approach with the activities? Or can we, because for my case, we actually have some need for front-end evaluation as well, where some, I guess, some prototyping could happen. I'm wondering as to kind of how you want us to approach, given now that I have a better awareness of the difference between the two.
Michelle, if you've got a good answer, jump in and interrupt me. But I would say that, you know, I think we do want this course to be as practical and as involved and as involved with your ongoing work as possible. So I think, you know, we can make sure that it fits the spirit of what we're trying to get out of the assignment. But I don't personally have a thought that you shouldn't do something that fits with what your work just because it might be more front-end evaluation than not. In fact, I think that's almost a better context because you are, you know, invested in it and you do have some thoughts about how to make it work better. I mean, you could go with something that's completely brand new to you and that, you know, you might learn something interesting, but you might also spectacularly fail because you just don't have a lot of history with it. So,
yeah, to add to that, I think try as best as you can to do prototyping and just think about what you can be doing that may also be suitable for the front end. So like we said, you know, if it comes down to signage or, you know, what a space might look like, you can prototype that in some way that may then just kind of kickstart the front end evaluation for you so that it is usable and relevant to the work that you're doing.
Okay. That's
So, go ahead. I was just going to say that, yeah, as we go forward, you know, negotiating your final project, we'll be in conversation about that, and so we can find something I think that'll fit for you. So, yeah, great.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I was coming from the context of, you know, I'm new to learning about more of this front end and formative evaluation on a more rigorous kind of side of things. We kind of always did it, but we never did it officially in evaluations,
right,
or anything. And then this term of prototyping and kind of defining which is which. So actually, you guys speaking to that just now was very helpful.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is going to cut us off, but we can definitely chat offline about that. Okay. I guess maybe we're not recording the end of this.
Yes.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Certainly,
well,
share some evaluation resources.
Yeah, and I would, you know, this is exactly what I'd encourage you to talk about with your peers in the discussions as well, because they're going to have similar sorts of experiences and can help navigate that as well. So thank you all again. I'm going to wrap up at this point, and we'll see you in upcoming modules then.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you so much, guys.
All right. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Hey, Michelle, are you still there?
Yes, I will hit end episode, which
will
cut off.
Oh, I was just going to say, do you want to just chat for a second? I mean, I'm amazed that we made that through an hour. Oh, my God.
Hi, Katie. It's Jenny.
Oh, hey, there's Jenny. All right. We are actually on air still, huh? Okay. We're just not recording.
Yeah, we can use that, but I think the recording, I don't know if it still records us or not. So.
Okay. Well, do you want me to, should we just hang up and talk, but maybe say hi to Jenny first for a second?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll call your phone.
Oh, you're both going to call. Okay, great.
Okay, do you see where to hit end episode?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'll call you right back.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.